BBC News at 3 o'clock. This is Anna Jones. Opposition parties have called on the Prime Minister's senior adviser, Dominic Cummings, to resign after it emerged that he travelled from London to his parents' home in County Durham when he and his wife were ill with coronavirus. A source close to Mr. Cummings denied any breach of the lockdown restrictions, saying the couple needed help with childcare. Here's our political correspondent, Jessica Parker.
It emerged in late March that Dominic Cummings had developed coronavirus symptoms and was self-isolating. Last night, The Mirror and Guardian reported that he travelled from his London property to his parents' home in Durham, 250 miles away. It's prompted calls from opposition parties for the Prime Minister's chief aide to resign or face the sack. The explanation from a source close to Mr. Cummings was that the journey was made so his parents could help with childcare, whilst he and his wife, unwell with COVID symptoms, stayed in a separate building. The source denied that Mr. Cummings had broken lockdown rules.
The accountancy firm EY says it expects a sharp rise in the number of businesses that won't pay their quarterly rent bills, which are due at the end of June. The economic shutdown has led to the widespread non-payment of commercial rent, but it means some landlords are struggling too. Ed Anderson, who runs three pubs in Cheltenham, is raising awareness of the issue by handing the keys of his business to his local MP.
Rent bills are £14,000 a month. It's what I wake up in the middle of the night thinking about. It's a Mexican standoff. I think all of hospitality is in the same position. There's an expectation for rent from landlords, and then there's an ability to pay rent from tenants, and there's a vast difference in between the two.
Three more people have been charged with the murder of a 19-year-old law student, Aya Hashem, who was killed in a drive-by shooting in Blackburn last weekend. In total, five people are due to appear at Preston Magistrates Court today in connection with her death. A man has been arrested in Sussex after a bomb disposal squad was sent to an address in Brighton. Several containers thought to contain petrol were discovered inside a flat. President Trump has said he wants churches, mosques and synagogues to reopen across the United States this weekend. He said he would override state governors if they tried to keep them closed under quarantine restrictions. Mr. Trump didn't explain what power he had to do so, but questioned why other services were allowed.
Some governors have deemed liquor stores and abortion clinics as essential, but have left out churches and other houses of worship. It's not right. So I'm correcting this injustice and calling houses of worship essential.
And some of this summer's major sporting events could still go ahead despite there being no exemption for competitors under new quarantine rules that come in next month. Organisers of the Grand Prix at Silverstone and a cricket test series against the West Indies say they remain hopeful despite requirements for 14 days of isolation. And that's the BBC News. It's 3 minutes past three.
Blur and Oasis may have ridden the Britpop zeitgeist into popular consciousness, but Suede made it possible. Before Suede, UK music was largely in the grip of post-grunge Americana. It was Brett Anderson's band who wrestled dominance from the Yanks and gave people a reason to be proud of their musical heritage again. They traded freely on the dark glamour and sexual ambiguity of Bowie and the Britishness of the Smiths, combining it with lyrics that perfectly suited a generation. The reason for speaking to today's guest, Suede singer Brett Anderson, was to find out where that music came from, but also to chart his inspirations, delve into the band's history, his relationship with Suede's mercurial guitarist Bernard Butler, his battle with drugs, as well as the band's rebirth, their eventual split, and their recent reunion. So this is The First Time with Brett Anderson. So we start, like we always start, this program with asking you when you first became aware of music, even as a small child.
Well, my father was like an obsessive classical music fan. So he was a kind of, he wasn't just a fan, he was a sort of a bit of a nut. He used to go to, he was obsessed with Franz Liszt, and he used to go to Franz Liszt's birthplace in Hungary or Austria every year, drive there in his Morris Traveller, and bring back a little sort of file of soil from Liszt's birthplace and kind of wear it around his neck for the rest of the year. He was this...
That's obsessive.
Yeah, he was a bit obsessive, yeah, yeah. I'm sure he would have been a Liszt groupie if Liszt hadn't have died 200 years before he was born. But so I was kind of brought up with kind of classical music blaring throughout the house. It was kind of quite a strange upbringing. Brought up in a tiny little council house down near Brighton. But there was quite a lot of... kind of culture, you know, and one of the strongest elements of culture I was exposed to was classical music. And so automatically, you know, like you do when you're a sort of 11, 12, 13 year old kid, you completely reject the values that your parents impose on you. And the first ever band that I was into was a band called Crass, which were kind of like a bizarre sort of like political kind of like post-punk band, and as far away from Franz Liszt as you could possibly get. So
what was your first brush with Crass then?
My first brush with Crass was buying a record at Hayward Heath Market called The Feed and the 5000, and not realising that it was supposed to be played at 45 RPM and playing it at 33 RPM, and this kind of like hearing this really slow down voice, you know, this kind of like almost like this kind of like satanical voice, and being fascinated to the point of being shocked at how kind of amazing it sounded. And then when someone told me at school it was actually supposed to be played at 45 RPM, it sort of lost some of the magic.
Was that the first record that you bought?
It wasn't. No, the first record I bought was the Sex Pistols, Never Mind the Bollocks, which is, yeah. I mean, it's still one of the greatest records ever made for me in my book. It's kind of an amazing piece of music and art or whatever you want to call it, yeah. But that was the first record I bought.
I don't wanna holiday, you know.
I was too sort of young to really be to be aware of the whole thing while it was happening with punk. You know, I was born in 67, so when punk was really happening, I was only 10. So it wasn't until a couple of years later that you start developing kind of like cultural consciousness, for want of a better phrase. And it kind of filtered through to me. And because I didn't live in Soho, you know, I lived in the suburbs, it kind of like, it took a couple of years to sort of filter down to us. I don't know, I suppose there was something very exciting about the whole punk thing. You know, it was kind of like really inverting traditional musical principles, sort of turning stuff on its head. And that probably appealed to me as a kind of like a snotty young teenager, yeah. I think it appealed to lots of people.
What was the first concert that you went to? Can you remember going to your first gig?
God, I think it was probably the first gig I went to was quite... didn't go to gigs for a while. I think the first gig I went to was New Order, actually, down in Brighton.
Good first gig.
Yeah. It was... God, when was it? It was sometime in the 80s. Must have been around the time of sort of Blue Monday, maybe slightly after that, yeah.
Did that make a big impression on you?
It did, yeah. I think the not as big an impression as seeing The Cult, actually. The Cult were one of the greatest live bands I'd ever seen, and that remains true to this day. I thought Ian Astbury had an amazing presence live, and they seemed to take the kind of like the whole sort of performance thing to a new level. So seeing The Cult in about 1984 was pretty special.
What's the Cult song that does it for you?
Well,
because I wouldn't immediately take you looking at your musical heritage.
No, it's a strange little anomaly, The Cult. But I was actually a member of the Cult fan club as well. I used to get a Cult newsletter. It's funny, wasn't it?
And your Cult fan club name will be Firewalker.
I mean, She Sells Sanctuary is, you know, one of the greatest rock records ever made. It's an astoundingly brilliant record, and it's still amazing today. I went to see them at the Albert Hall a couple of months ago, and it was just like, you know, they played Love, the album that's from, which is a fine album, but, you know, the mood was great and everyone was, you know, enjoying it. And then they suddenly played that song, and just the whole place erupted, because it is an amazing song, and it's one of the greatest riffs.
At what point did loving this music and getting enthusiastic about this music start to kind of sink in with, well, I want to do that. That's what I want to do. Was there a moment when you realised that you wanted to be the person rather than watching the singer, being the singer?
Yeah, I think there was. I mean, you know, it was quite a strange time in the 80s because there was a lot of great music being made, but it was all kind of in the underground, I think. There wasn't, you know, mainstream music was pretty horrible. There was about two acts, you know, looking back at the 80s, you know, Prince and the Pet Shop Boys that were in the mainstream that I actually liked, and everything else was things like the Smiths and the Fall and New Order and stuff like that, which were fantastic. But, you know, when you used to watch Top of the Pops in those days, it was kind of like those are sort of weird bands with lots of hair. And I did remember watching Top of the Pops one day and just thinking, God, I can do better than this. This is just so boring and bad. And it's time to sort of have a go myself, you know. So finally got, you know, sick of being frustrated and started some bands together. Met Matt Osman at college, the bass player in Suede, and he had a goth band called Paint It Black, which
Paint
I joined.
Paint It Black.
Yeah,
that's,
I know.
That's a good name for a goth band.
It's a very good name for a goth. But Matt used to be a goth, you know. That's what Suede fans don't realise about him. He's eternally embarrassed about it. But I've got pictures of him with back-combed hair and a paisley shirt.
Nice.
Yeah.
What was the first band called?
The first band that we were in was called Paint It Black.
All right, okay.
So yeah.
You were part of
that.
Yeah,
but
band.
It was sort of, you know, all of these bands are just sort of, you know, they're all kind of, it's all just sort of learning your craft, really. You know, there's nothing to be taken seriously from them. We were also in another band called Jeff, which was almost like a House Martins-inspired band, you know. So, like anyone of that age, you're kind of just, you know, you're just sort of sucking in all the influences in a very crass way and kind of, you know, reflecting them in a very obvious way, and it's all just sort of part of the whole learning process. And I think it's, you need to have that kind of, like, you know, that process in order to learn how not to do it, almost, I think, you know. And it's not until, you know, years and years later that you get proficient enough and confident enough to actually do it yourself with any elegance.
And in a way that's yours, rather than just aping someone else's style.
Exactly, yeah. Or, you know, to take influences and to sort of twist them and use them in your own voice, you know.
In terms of influences, the Smiths is a name that always comes up when people talk about Suede.
Mm.
When did you first hear the Smiths?
First heard the Smiths. I mean, I'd heard the Smiths, but the first time it really, really got through to me, I think I was listening to John Peel, like most kind of kids did, who had any sort of taste in 1983, you know, and I heard What Difference Does It Make, and there's a line in What Difference Does It Make which is, but still I'd leap in front of a flying bullet for you, and it just really struck me as really powerful and beautiful. And from then on I did really love the Smiths, and they were very kind of important band for me growing up. I was sort of like going through adolescence at a time when they were at their peak, and lots of their material was about the confusion of adolescence, so it kind of resonated doubly with me, you know, at the time.
But I'm still fond of you. Oh, oh, oh. proud of you. But no more apologies. No more, no more apologies. Oh, I'm too tired. I'm so sick and tired. And I'm feeling very sick and ill today. But I'm still fond of you. Oh,
first meet Bernard Butler, one of the most important meetings.
Me, Justine and Matt had started a band. We weren't called Suede yet. We were called, oh God, something like The Perfect or something awful like that. And we were kind of like, you know, writing these sort of dippy little kind of hippie songs inspired by Joni Mitchell and stuff. You know, it's all very acoustic and sort of like nicey, nicey, nice. And we kind of got sick of, you know, not really doing anything and getting nowhere. And we decided to put an advert in the NME, and I put an advert in the NME saying, listing a few influences, and I just, you know, one of the things I said was, you know, no musos, but no beginners, you know, we wanted someone that was, that's the thing, if you put adverts in the music press, you'll just end up with sort of like people that are into heavy metal bands and can do all of this sort of shredding and, you know, this technical nonsense that no one really cares about except people that, you know, read Kerrang. So we wanted someone, you know, like Bernard to answer the advert, and Bernard answered it, so that was nice. And then we met him, and I remember we had a little rehearsal in my flat at the time. It was a place called Highlever Road, just by Kent, just by Labrook Grove, and he came along, and you know, obviously he was an absolutely amazing guitar player, and he was very young and very intense and very shrewd. And there was no doubt in my mind that we could do something pretty special together, yeah.
The first Suede gig that had the, you know, the lineup that went on to start recording professionally, what was that first concert like? Do you remember?
I can't remember the exact first gig, but the first gig that anyone ever half paid attention was a thing called On for 92, which was part of the NME sort of end-of-year celebrations in 1991 at the venue. And we played with a couple of other bands, a band called Fabulous and a band called Adorable. And it was the first time anyone had ever sort of noticed us or written about us or anything like that. I think the NME wrote a little piece about it.
When did you start to feel that there was something happening? I mean, even before The Drowners, which was the first single, there seemed to be a certain amount of kerfuffle.
Yeah, I think we first really noticed things happening where I think our first ever kind of proper review was we played the Falcon in Camden Town, and Morrissey turned up and Suggs turned up and Kirsty McColt, and it's like, what are they doing here? How weird. Because we didn't, you know, you didn't really know, but obviously there was a bit of a word of mouth sort of thing. And then there was a review in the NME, and it sort of, we were very proud of it, you know, it was just this little review, but it sort of seemed to really get us.
And what did it say?
It's just the reference points, you know, some of the sort of, you know, Bowie, Smith's reference points and stuff like that. And it picked out some songs that we were proud of, and it, I can't remember exactly what it said, but it sort of reflected back at us what we were trying to achieve almost, which is something that you're not quite sure of if you're just ploughing away in your own little space, if you know what I mean. If you're not having the media reflected back at you and you're trying to create a new sound, you almost need someone outside to judge it and to sort of like to evaluate it sometimes. And that was the first time we'd actually read what someone else thought of our band, which was quite interesting.
The Drowners was your first single proper, and sort of straight away,
yeah,
said the impact of it was enormous. Do you remember recording it and after the session listening back and going, this is right, this is what we intended to do,
this
will have the desired effect?
I think we're all really, really proud of that record. I think I still think it's a great record, The Drowners. I listened back to it recently. We've been doing stuff for the Best of Suede and listening back to the old songs, and Drowners is one of those ones that really still stands up. It's a great record.
BBC Sounds.
I'm Matt Everett, and this is the first time where we look at the key moments in an artist's career. And today's subject is Brett Anderson from Suede, and you just heard Metal Mickey, the band's second single from 1992. When the band's self-titled first album came out a year later, it was a huge hit both critically and commercially, thrusting the band into the mainstream media spotlight. I asked Brett how that felt.
It wasn't intimidating. I think it's what we always wanted. I think we always wanted to kind of reach a bit further than the indie ghetto. You know, I didn't just want to be a kind of a grey band, sort of like chugging away at a guitar, looking at my shoes. I think we always wanted to sort of we had sort of aspirations towards making pop music and kind of connecting with real people rather than just music obsessives. So it wasn't scary. It was sort of like what we always wanted. You know, we always thought the point of it was to go a little bit further than that. Yeah.
But there's that thing about, you know, be careful what you wish for. If you kind of adulation and mainstream crossover, success, then when you get there, it's never quite the way you expect.
No, absolutely. And it's, you know, looking back on it, it's, you know, I almost wish that we had sort of kind of contained our ambition a little bit and been a little bit, you know, less, you know, shooting for the stars in a funny sort of way. We just went off on a tangent and just like, right, we're going to be the greatest, biggest band ever sort of thing. And, you know, you always kind of fall down to earth, you know.
One of the other things that the album is supposed to kind of signify is the kind of opening salvo of like US music dominance of the British market was kind of shaken. And Stone Roses and Manchester to an extent, but this felt like music for the UK by the UK, the UK, without being nationalistic about it, but it felt very much like that. Was that an intentional?
It was very unintentional. Obviously I didn't have those kind of, you know, what I was doing was intentional, but it was just meant to be a document of my life. My life lived as a sort of like a kind of, you know, a person living in the city, a poor white boy living in the city. That's what it was. And, you know, it became almost like, you know, this sort of like blueprint for Britpop and all those sorts of things, you know. But when I was first writing, I was just trying to be honest about my life and how I saw it. I wasn't trying. I didn't want to sort of write in rock cliches. I didn't want to write, you know, using John Lennon's words or Jimi Hendrix's words or Jim Morrison's words. I wanted to sort of like write about Brett Anderson's life, and you know, that's what I did. And because some of that, you know, was kind of it kind of just got twisted and turned into something that I didn't intend at first, I think.
When the follow-up came out, Dogman Star, which is regarded as one of the band's masterpiece in many ways, the second record.
Yeah.
At the time, it wasn't regarded as that at all.
No.
It didn't really connect with people, partially because at the time, you mentioned Britpop, we have to cover it. You were surrounded by your Park Lifes and you were surrounded by your Definitely Maybes. Do you remember that album coming out and thinking, this is just not... I can see why people aren't going to get this, because it's all Dayglow, Chirpy Cockneys and Surly Northerners.
Well,
not like that.
We deliberately made the record not like that, because as soon as we were aware of this sort of like jingoistic, nationalistic kind of cartoon thing that was happening, we wanted to make something that rejected that. It's an album about kind of like loneliness and alienation and ambition and very, very kind of like un-Britpop notions. But it was a shame what happened with that album, because I think more than just the sort of Britpop thing happening in parallel was also the fact that Bernard had left the band, and that kind of issue clouded people's judgment of it as well.
When did you first realise he was going to leave? Or that he was no longer wanted in the band? Pick your answer.
Yeah, well, no, God. I've been asked this question so many times, and it's sort of difficult. I can't even really remember exactly what happened, to be honest. You know, I think we both wanted different things out of Suede. You know, that's the truth of it. I think it's a tragedy that he did leave the band. You know, I think that the Dogman Star and the debut Suede album are really good records and still stand up today. And I do think sometimes I wonder what a third Suede album with Bernard would have been like. And but you know, you never know. No one will ever know. It's one of those what ifs. Maybe it was just supposed to sort of burn brightly and burn for a short time. You know, we were talking about the Sex Pistols earlier, and you know, you don't really want to hear a second Sex Pistols album, do you? You just got one album.
There was a beauty to that, I suppose.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a beauty in its transience, and yeah.
It's also a record that's rumoured to be dominated by some reasonably prolific drug use. Was that the case as well?
Yeah, there was lots of, you know, drugs flying around, but that was part of the, you know, the lifestyle at the time. It was pretty crazy. Yeah, absolutely. there's lots of quite sort of surreal kind of visions on the record. You know, at that time I was kind of like, I was just floating off. I was off on one.
Do you think that was a reaction to the expectations for the record? Because a lot was expected off that record. No matter how strange you're making it and how you're trying to do something that's separate to what's going on, it was the second Suede album. The first record had been such a massive crossover success.
I don't know. I wasn't really... I'm not sure if I was consciously worried about that. I think I was aware that it had to be really special, but I certainly wasn't aware of it having to sort of shift a certain number of units. We really didn't think about that. In fact, quite the opposite. I think we were trying to make us quite an uncompromising record. I mean, the first sort of like, you know, version of the song Asphalt World was I think, about 18 minutes long. You know, it wasn't until we actually kind of like got in there and edited it. It's quite out there. We were trying to make a record that was, like I say, quite uncompromising.
When did you first decide that you were going to carry on, though? Or was that an immediate decision? Had you planned that out as a group or personally?
After Bernard had left, you mean?
Yeah.
I think there wasn't a question of splitting up, actually. I think I think it was quite almost bloody-minded. Do you know what I mean? It was like everyone expected us to split up, and so we decided we weren't going to. We were going to carry on, and it was quite important for us to do that, I think. We felt that there was like a kind of spirit in the band that should be bigger than, you know, tiffs. And we went about looking for a replacement for Bernard, which is a huge thing to do, but we did it quite casually at the time, I think. You know, looking back at it now, you know, I think it was a thing we did with the arrogance of youth, if you know what I mean. I'm not sure if I'd approach it in the same way now, but we just kind of like blithely carried on and said, yeah, we can get a replacement. And we got Richard Oakes, who was very young at the time. And I heard a cassette that he'd actually sent into the office. He just heard that Bernard had left the band, and he just, off his own steam, just sort of sent a cassette in, and it was actually him playing My Insatiable One. And I just heard it and instinctively thought, well, he's pretty amazing, actually. He can really play. Didn't know how young he was. Called up, I managed to call the house, the number that he'd left, and his mum answered, and he was like, you know, he was like an 18-year-old, you know, just at college. So, yeah. That was a whole kettle of fish.
So what were you listening to in terms of the music you were kind of being influenced by? Because Dogman Star is a very different record. Then you've kind of got this period where potential reinvention, what are you going to do for the record to follow up? What were the... Can you remember the things that were affecting you musically at that time?
I wasn't really listening to much contemporary music, actually.
Old stuff?
I didn't listen to much contemporary music at the time. Old stuff... I suppose sort of like, you know, lots of things like T-Rex at the time and the Kinks and things like that I was listening
to. Pure pop.
Yeah, I was really, really quite obsessed with a T-Rex album called Tanks. For some reason, that just really connected with me. It was kind of a slightly obscure album. But I just really liked the whole T-Rex thing, and that's what informed the next Suede album coming up.
What's the track off Tanks? That
There's a song called Broken Hearted Blues, which I really love, actually.
What is it about
really
that
beautiful.
Track?
I don't really know. It's just really like, it's kind of like a sort of mid-tempo ballad song, but it's beautiful.
This is a song that I wrote when I was young, and I called it the Broken Hearted Blues. The air on that night.
That record coming up, 1996, first down with a new lineup. It caught everyone off guard by being critically very well received.
Yeah.
Musically very strong and very popular as well. Mm. It kind of, it's the holy trinity of what you want, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And it did kind of work, that one.
That
yeah.
must have felt pretty good.
It did, yeah. It's kind of weird. I think lots of people have counted the band out and just assumed that, yeah, it's not, they're not going to recover from this sort of body blow of Bernard leaving. And we were kind of determined to prove everyone wrong. And I kind of... It was almost like a... It was a very, very important record, that, for us, coming up, to make that record successful and to make it a really good record. You know, I put so much of my blood, sweat and tears into that record, you know. It was almost like... I felt as though, get that right and everything falls into place, get it wrong and it's all over. Do you know what I mean? It was a real pivotal moment in our career, I thought. And we wanted to make a pop record, you know, after Dogman Star, which was a very, quite a dank,
good word.
Emotionally tortured record.
It's a dank record.
It's a dank
it's
record.
It's a glorious record.
Gloriously dank.
Yeah, it's kind of like, so yeah, gilded but dank.
I think there's almost the green, the cover, the greenness of it, almost like there's a sort of like underwater quality it's got. You know, it's like the bottom of a swimming pool that hasn't been cleaned for a few years. You know, or, you know, anyway, I won't elaborate. And coming up was very much, you know, the polar opposite of that. It was supposed to be a bright, communicative kind of pop record, you know. No flab on it, you know, lots of... We wanted it almost to be an album of singles, sort of 10 singles.
And that was a good time for the band?
It was a great time for the band. It was like being a sort of new band again. Coming up was like another debut, actually, so it had all that kind of like energy of a debut album again. It's very exciting, yeah.
Whereas Head Music, the follow-up, didn't fare quite as well and seemed to mark, not divisions, but cracks in
yeah.
the band.
Mm.
Why, you know, off the back of one great record, you've saved your careers. Mm. Why did things take a turn, not for the dank, but...
Yeah, I think we wanted to make a different sounding record. Again, I don't think we wanted to make a guitar pop record, so automatically you're sort of taking it into a new territory.
What sort of stuff were you listening to at the time? Was this another left turn for you?
Yeah, a lot more electronic music, you know. Kind of bands like Asian Dub Foundation and things like that, and Audio Web and stuff like that, I was kind of quite enjoying, and sort of classic sort of like dance stuff like Blue Monday and things like that, you know. So, and Tricky, that first Tricky album I used to really like, a song called Black Steel on it, which I loved. So all of that kind of like more kind of like sort of darker, dirtier side of electronica, and I think we were trying to introduce some of that stuff into it, you know. And I think half of Head Music actually does that quite successfully. There's a song called Can't Get Enough, which I really love, which does that really well. And things like Savoir Faire and stuff like that. And there's a song on it, She's in Fashion as well, which is, even though it's not a dark, sort of dirty side of electronica, it still has some of those influences. It's still a kind of quite a economic sort of pop record. And that's probably the most successful track on the album.
When did you first think that maybe the band's proclivity for overindulgence might be a problem?
Well, making that record was, you know, was hard. You know, I was taking lots of drugs at the time, and that was interfering with my creativity and it was interfering with my relationships with the rest of the band. Neil had developed ME and pretty much couldn't get out of bed, and that was a problem because I'd kind of sort of started writing with Neil a bit more than I'd started writing with Richard. You know, I think that was in turn led to Richard losing his self-confidence a little bit because he was felt as though he'd been sidelined, and I was too off my face and off on some ego trip anyway to be sensitive to what he felt about it, sort of thing. So there was a lot of kind of like the whole equilibrium of the and sort of hierarchy and structure of the band had been really upset by that, and it led to Head Music, and for better or for worse, I'm kind of strangely quite proud of that record, even though it doesn't really remind me of great times. It's actually, I think, quite a mad little record.
When did the cracks become impossible to plaster over anymore? When did you first think that the future of the band was in doubt.
Yeah, I think possibly we should have split up after Head Music. I think that probably would have been, in terms of our, you know, without wanting to sound pompous, in terms of our legacy or whatever, that would have been better. You know, we shouldn't have made the fifth album, A New Morning. It was an album that was made in kind of like, we were quite confused about what we wanted the band to be. I didn't quite know where I wanted to go with it. Who were, you know, I was trying to reinvent it.
As what?
Don't know. I mean, you know, there's part of me that sort of almost wanted to make it almost like a folk record. You know, quite acoustic and quite beautiful and harmonies and stuff like that, you know.
What sort of thing were your touch points for that?
I was listening to Grandaddy a lot, actually, you know, and I liked the way that they kind of combined sort of mellow folk with kind of electronica. I thought it was really an incredibly beautiful and surprising combination that they managed to do really well. But I don't think I was focused enough at the time to make it work, and it just, we actually had a couple of cracks at that record. We made a version of it with a guy called Tony Hoffer, this American producer who'd worked with Beck, and ended up scrapping it because it just sounded terrible, and we ended up redoing it with Stephen Street, and that's the version that you hear.
First kind of going public and saying the band was over, that must have been really emotional, because, you know,
yeah, it was hard
thing to do.
Yeah, it was really hard. It's like, you know, it's like kind of breaking up a family or something like that. I thought about it for a year before I actually did it.
As long as that?
Yeah. I thought about it for a long, long time. I kind of like thought about it and deliberated. And
were you putting it off because you were scared of what would happen?
I was putting it off because I couldn't decide whether it was the right thing to do or not. It's a huge decision to make, and I certainly didn't make it lightly. And I think it was, looking back on it, the right thing to do, because I did feel sort of at the end of the line creatively. I didn't know where to take it. And I think when you feel like that, you've got to be honest with yourself and kind of like initiate a change that addresses that. And for me, breaking the band up and doing what I, and having done what I've done subsequently, has really woken me up as an artist. You know, I don't know if we'd have made a six suede album or a seven suede album, it might have just kind of like gradually drifted into obsolescence, you know.
And then there was this whole hoo-ha about, oh, he's going to speak to Bernard again, he's going to speak, they've been spotted. Two people that looked a bit like them were spotted buying a Quest or somewhere in Camden. My God, two people that might have been them were spotted somewhere in Nottingham in a music shop. Or this whole...
Yeah.
Which must have been quite funny, because I think only you two could have probably looked at it from the inside and gone, this is a bit ridiculous, we're just, you know,
yeah,
some music, or maybe we won't.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I did call Bernard after the band had split. Yeah, it's, you know, I hadn't spoken to him for 9 years. And, you know, we'd made some pretty good stuff together, and I gave him a call. And we went out, had a beer, and had a curry, and talked about making another record again. And we formed the Tears. And,
are you proud of the music you did with him then?
I really am, actually. I think that's a great record. It kind of... Yeah, I think it could have been, maybe it was a bit long. Maybe if it was a 13-song album, maybe if it was a 10-song album, it would have been a lot more focused. But I think it's a great record. I think there's a couple of good songs on there. Apollo 13, Autograph, Love as Strong as Death, they're great tracks. Yeah, I really enjoyed working with him again. It was fantastic, you know, and it sort of like, it did wake me up as an artist. I think I'd sort of like become a little bit, you know, you can get sort of set in your ways and you can have too much power, and then working with someone where the power is even again, you know, where it's a kind of equal relationship, I think it's probably pretty good for you.
Do you find yourself more comfortable kind of helming a ship of a band, or kind of working very much on your own, floating on your own, having to find your own solutions to the songs that you're writing?
I mean, both situations are great in different ways, you know. I did really miss, you know, 7 years, 5 years or whatever, being away from Suede. I sort of did miss the kind of momentum that you can get with a band. But I do love being able to make those decisions for yourself. You know, I loved making the solo records I made. I loved the fact that my second solo album was an album just of me and a cello player. And those are the kind of things that you simply can't do if you're in a band. That kind of freedom and that kind of like, you know, yeah, you just can't do that. So, yeah, both situations are fantastic in different ways.
We've had all these firsts And we always finish the show with the last record, which is a record that you can choose, which is either something of yours or something that you've loved from your past or anything that you want. The last record is chosen by you.
Well, I guess I'll choose what I have to say is probably my favourite song that I've ever written, been involved with, whatever. It's The Wild Ones from Dogman Star.
Why is that song so important to you?
I don't know, really. It's manages to be bitter and sweet in the perfect proportion, which is one of those sort of songwriter's holy grails. It just captures something, and I'm just really proud of that, and it's one of those songs that just does it for me, so.
Then we shall play it. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for speaking to me.
Thank you very much.
A pleasure.
There's a song playing on the radio. Sky high in the airwaves on the morning show.
That was The First Time with me, Matt Everett, and my guest, Brett Anderson.
This is Radio 2 on the BBC Sounds app, on your smart speaker, and on 88 to 91 FM.
BBC News at 4 o'clock. This is Anna Jones. Opposition parties are putting pressure on the Prime Minister to sack his top adviser, Dominic Cummings, after he travelled from London to County Durham during the lockdown. A source close to Mr Cummings has said it was so his parents could help care for his young child while he and his wife were both ill with coronavirus symptoms. The Guardian columnist Owen Jones has accused him of hypocrisy.
The idea that millions of families have to abide by a set of rules they don't like, they find upsetting, they find distressing, that have put strains on their families, that Dominic Cummings is above the very rules that his government has set, is indefensible.
The accountancy firm EY says it expects a rise in the number of businesses that won't pay their quarterly rent bills, which are due at the end of next month. The economic shutdown has led to the widespread non-payment of commercial rent, which means some landlords are struggling too, as our business correspondent Katie Prescott reports.
According to EY, the largest drop in rent collection has been in the retail, hospitality and leisure sectors, with retail landlords collecting only 44% of rent due in March. This compares to 66% in the office sector and 83% in the industrial sector. Some landlords are deferring rent, giving tenants payment holidays or charging them monthly. But this is difficult for landlords with their own financial commitments. Business groups are asking the government to underwrite rents for shut shops or to implement a 9-month rent holiday. The government says it has given an unprecedented package of support to businesses, including loans and rates relief to support them through the pandemic.
Five people are due in court later today, charged with the murder of a 19-year-old law student who was killed in a drive-by shooting in Blackburn last Sunday. They're also accused of the attempted murder of a man who police believe was the intended target of the attack. 97 people are now believed to have been killed when a Pakistani passenger plane crashed into a residential area in the city of Karachi yesterday. The Pakistan International Airlines flight from Lahore was carrying 99 passengers and crew, with many families travelling ahead of tomorrow's Eid holiday. President Trump has told US state governors they must reopen places of worship which have been closed because of the coronavirus. He threatened to overrule those who don't follow his wishes. Montse Alvarado is from a law firm which is representing groups in Minnesota which are planning to defy the state's lockdown measures there.
The worry right now is over the parity that is lacking, the equal access that is lacking to reopening. If a government is looking to open bars and casinos and beauty parlors and tattoo parlors, they should be allowing churches to do the same.
And the first manned space mission in 9 years to take off from US soil will begin next Wednesday. Two astronauts will be sent to the International Space Station on board a rocket and a capsule, which has been provided by the commercial company SpaceX. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past four.